You're listening to Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow. Just over a year ago, scientists deliberately crashed. They crashed a section of a rocket into a dark lunar crater and flew a spacecraft, the L-Cross probe it's called, through the debris kicked up by the impact. They wanted to see what was released and, analyze the debris. Well, shortly after that experiment, the news came back that the team had found water. But yesterday, the researchers expanded and clarified their findings, and it turns out that they found a good deal of water, enough they estimate to extract a few gallons out of a few wheelbarrows of lunar soil. They also described finding other surprising ingredients in the lunar soil, and the details are all in several papers published this week in the journal Science. Joining me now is Michael Wargo. He is the chief lunar scientist in NASA's Exploration Systems Mission Directorate. That's based at NASA headquarters in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thanks, Ira. It's really great to be with you.
Thank you. How much water did you find?
Well, I think you put it about right. If you had a good-sized wheelbarrow, and you filled it up about a half a dozen times, you'd be able to get 10 or 12 gallons of water out of it.
Okay.
Another way to say that is the Sahara Desert's pretty dry. This is about twice as wet as the Sahara Desert is on average. So one of the things that's really surprising to us is that in this particular place on the moon, it appears to be wetter than some of the driest places on Earth. And I think that surprises a lot of folks, considering after Apollo, when we analyzed the Apollo samples, we pretty much found an awful lot of stuff that was just plain bone dry.
Well, I got lots of questions about that. First, in the Sahara, you can't just see the water in the sand. Can
right.
you see the water in the rock here? You can't see it that way either, I imagine.
Well, there are waters.
How was the water
in a couple of different forms.
Yeah.
One was as crystalline water ice. So it's there, chemically connected to the rock as it is in the Sahara, but it's there as real water.
Secondly, what other kinds of stuff? I know that you found other kinds of surprising stuff down there.
Yeah, there is. And when we first impacted this upper stage of the Centaur rocket about a year ago, when we were talking about it, I was saying, this was like these dark craters are like the dusty attic of the solar system. There's all kinds of stuff there.
Mm-hmm.
But it really appears that it's more like an old deep freeze in your basement that you haven't defrosted for a couple of billion years and that's been kept at temperatures only a few tens of degrees above absolute zero. So it'll collect all kinds of things down there, including not just the water, but we've seen the signatures for methane, for carbon dioxide, carbon monoxide, volatile metals like sodium and mercury. There's all kinds of stuff there.
And where exactly on the moon is this crater? If we were looking at the moon out tonight, I think it's almost full or close to it.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And if you go out and look at the bottom of the moon, that's where the South Pole is. One of the reasons we were concentrating on the poles was that the way in which the moon orbits around the Earth and spins on its axis, it turns out that the axis of rotation is almost directly perpendicular to the line to the sun, so that there are these really long shadows that occur at the poles. And so some of the deep craters there haven't seen the light of the sun for about for a couple of billion years. And when things are that dark, that long, they can get really, really cold. And some of the temperatures that we measured in there are only a few tens of degrees above absolute zero.
Wow.
So the crater is called Cabeus, and it's near the south pole of the moon. And the target that we selected in there was based on some measurements that we were making with our other mission to the moon, Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, and it's still there. And we have a instrument on board that's able to map out the temperatures across the surface of the moon. And we found some of the coldest places, the coldest temperatures ever measured in the solar system. So this this isn't just cold, it's really cold.
Wow.
And we also had a neutron detector on board. And it turns out that neutrons at the moon give us a signal and a hint as to where hydrogen is. And at a on a prior mission to the moon, we saw a signature that says, hey, at these poles, it looks like there's a lot more hydrogen than there is any other place on the moon. Well, you kind of put those things together with the information we were getting back from Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, and we chose Cabeus Crater because it had one of the coldest temperatures that we measured at the moon, and it had the signature for the highest levels of hydrogen. So we figured that was the best place to go hunting for water.
Let's go to Skip in Cortez, Florida. Hi, Skip.
Hi, how you doing today?
Hi there.
My question is, you know, I keep hearing these things about, you know, these discoveries of water and this and that and the other thing, and I'm thinking, how can you have a molecule of water in an absolute vacuum?
Why doesn't it ablate or boil off or something like that?
Yeah, why doesn't it just gas off into a gas and separate into hydrogen and oxygen?
Well, and it turns out
I never have understood that. Maybe somebody can explain that to me.
I think I got the guy right here for you, Skip, is going to explain.
Yeah, and I think when you look at the rocks that we brought back from Apollo, the fact that we didn't see a whole lot of water connected with those is a direct evidence of, that the mechanism that you were talking about really does work, that, you know, things get hot enough and it's in a vacuum, so the water molecules go away. But where do they go? You know, there's still gravity on the moon, and when those water molecules hop off of those hot rocks, they land somewhere else, and they'll hop around on the surface of the moon, and if they hop into one of these unbelievably cold craters, so much energy gets taken out of that molecule that they can't hop out of the crater. So they build up over time. That's one of the mechanisms that's proposed for why you find water in these really, really cold, dark areas.
Wow, Skip, does that answer your question? Oh, Skip, I guess he's gone. Answers my question. Is there enough water? Is there enough water theoretically that you could mine the water if you needed to not want to bring it with you from Earth if you were having a manned or personed mission to the moon?
Yeah, well, one of the things we can look at is what did we actually measure? And what we actually measured were the kind of descriptions of water that you and I talked about when we started our discussion. And that's because it's based on the actual measurements made by our spacecraft, the instruments on the spacecraft, and the interpretation of those measurements. Now, if you start to extrapolate beyond what we actually measured to what could be there, then, of course, our level of uncertainty increases. But when you take the kind of levels that we saw, and that's about 5% of what's there, 5.5% by weight, and you extend it out over a distance of, say, on the order of 5 or 10 kilometers in a circle, you end up with a whole lot of water. But remember, you've made an extrapolation, and we understand and fully expect that there are significant uncertainties associated with that. Mm-hmm. The other thing to think about is that these temperatures are truly unbelievably cold, some of the coldest places in the solar system. So if you were going to go and try to use that water and mine it, you'd be mining it under really, really terrifically cold, harsh conditions.
How far out does does an area like this extend? Is it like the shadow of a building? Is it like a, you know, a crater? I'm trying to get a visual image of how far that really cold area would be out.
Yeah. Well, these cold areas are many kilometers in size, so they're big. They're shadows, but they're shadows from whole mountain ranges, and that mountain range is really the rim of a big crater. But the thing that we also found, and I think this is one of the most intriguing part of our results, is that when we measured those temperatures and we measured these neutron signatures, One of the early predictions was that they were all going to be in these really dark areas. But what we found was that there were temperature signals saying that down deep, maybe a meter or two below the surface, you get to temperatures where you can preserve this water as ice in vacuum for billions of years. So it's, there are some places where we might expect to find water ice where it's not dark, where it's lit by the sun.
Wow.
And that really makes it intriguing with respect to potentially trying to use it.
Well, what about what about those really – I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
That's right.
Finish your thought.
Oh, it was just that if you had your choice of working in these really dark, very cold areas, like at the bottom of Cabeas Crater, or working next to it where the light of the sun shows up and you can work in sunshine – but you have to drill down or dig down a little bit deeper and find the water, that might be an easier way to prospect and use the water than where it's really dark and really cold.
Mm-hmm. A couple of quick questions for you. A tweet came in. Randy Lamond wants to know, how much helium-3 is there?
Well, the measurements that we were making with the Lunar Crater Observation and Sensing Satellite, that's a mouthful, so we call it LCROSS, and the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, or LRO, we don't have instruments on there that are able to measure helium-3. But based on the measurements that were made from the lunar soils from that were returned from Apollo, as well as predictions based on the implantation of helium-3 from the solar wind, there's quite a bit of helium-3 on the moon that could potentially be useful for nuclear fusion. Unfortunately, we don't have a way to controllably provide power by nuclear fusion, and you would have to sift through a very, very large amount of lunar soil to get the helium-3 that you would use for power production.
What? Details. We don't have nuclear fusion. It's always 30 years away, so just, you know, 30 years from now. Let's go to Wanexa, Kansas. Hi, Elijah.
Hi, yeah. Kind of a far-fetched question, but we're hearing talks about, you know, Russia wants to build a hotel on the moon. Has there been anything about building, like, a particle accelerator in these, like, super cold areas you're talking about where we have to keep these incredibly powerful magnets at incredibly low temperatures? Is there any talk about something like that?
Yeah, why? Well, you wouldn't need the magnets.
Yeah, you wouldn't need the
The helium, but you'll need the magnets, but probably not the helium.
Right, that's certainly true. But then, just look at the environment that you'd have to be working in. You know, we think it's pretty cold outside when it's you know, when it gets to a few tens of degrees below 0 centigrade. Now go 200 degrees below 0 centigrade. And, boy, that's a real tough area to work in. It makes for a nice Gedanken or thought experiment, though.
1-800-989-8255 is a number. This is Science Friday from NPR. I'm Ira Flatow talking with Michael Wargo. You know, now, don't you feel frustrated, though, that now, just as you've made this discovery of water and the other substances in the coldest possible place in the solar system, that we've turned around and said, we're not going back to the moon. We've canceled our manned space plans to go back there.
Well, what we do have, though, is we have all of this really valuable information that is both timely in that it's available now as we continue our planning, but it's also timeless. This stuff isn't going anywhere. And as we find out more and more information about it, we're able to plan better. And while the moon may not be our next destination with a crew, it's still part of the future look as a destination for where we would want to be going. And we're going to have that information as well as all of those highly precise and accurate maps that we're getting from Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So we're going to be ready to go, and that data is going to continue to be valuable as the scientific community analyzes it, and as we're able to use it for planning.
And we may not go, but the Indians or the Chinese or somebody else might go and could use that data.
Well, there have been missions to the moon, a number of them in the last couple of years, of which R2 are only a pair of examples, and there are ongoing plans to return to the moon, and so does NASA. NASA has plans to do a high precision mapping of the gravity field of the moon from our science mission directorate in a mission called GRAIL, and also to study the tenuous atmosphere of the moon, as well as to study the behavior of dust particles at the moon in a mission called LADEE. So there's an awful lot of continuing and ongoing interest, and the interest is increasing the more and more we learn about the moon, and particularly the more and more we learn about the moon and how different it is than we just thought only a year or two ago.
In about a minute that I have left, let me give you the blank check question. If you could send a mission and without sending people to the moon to explore something, what do you want to explore? What do you want to find out? Where would you like to dig next or look at next?
Well, when we went in Apollo, we concentrated near the equator of the moon. And with the missions that we have now, we know that the poles are really, really different from the near equatorial regions. So in my mind, those next kind of missions would be back to the poles. You have almost continuous sunlight in some locations. In fact, it's right next to some of these really dark areas that are dark all the time. You have areas that are lit almost 100% of the time, so solar power becomes really valuable to you. You know the resources are there, so you have a chance to go prospecting. It's one thing to know that you have a resource in one location. It's another to know what the extent of those resources are and whether they're going to be valuable to you.
All right. To the poles. That's what they said 100 years ago. But they didn't talk about the moon. All right.
And we're just a little bit colder than they were.
Thank you very much, Michael, for taking time to be with us.
Absolutely my pleasure, Ira.
Same slogan, different place. Michael Wargo is a chief lunar scientist and NASA's Exploration Systems Mission Director. That's based at NASA headquarters in Washington.